This is Dear Analyst, episode 18. And in this episode, I'm going to be reading a few passages from the book Range by David Epstein. And I was supposed to do this episode actually last episode, episode 17, but because of Microsoft Excel's new XLOOKUP feature, which has taken the Excel world by storm, I had to put off this episode by one, but this one will be all about the book Range and the applications I've found for it in my own life. So a quick summary of what Range, the book, is by David Epstein. It basically argues that if you start learning a specialized skill early on in your, starting from your childhood into your adult life, you may not be as happy, you may not find that path as rewarding as if you tried to be a generalist or someone who stumbles into different hobbies and skills and interests throughout your life. And so it basically argues for individuals to have a generalist approach to life and learning and skill development versus starting to learn the violin when you're 5 years old and trying to become a master when you are an adult. And David paints this picture of Roger Federer and Tiger Woods, and how Tiger Woods kind of was brought up to be a golf player from early on, and Federer was kind of like discovering tennis throughout his life and then eventually became this really amazing tennis player. And there's a few passages that kind of really struck out to me from the book, and I'm going to read them right now because they just kind of showcase how being able to stumble into things, being able to be spontaneous as you learn, really gives you an upper hand when it comes to rewards and success further down in life. And I'm going to try to relate all of this back to learning Excel and being proficient in Excel down the line. All right, so here is the first passage. This is on page 48 of Range. And let me see where I should start off. Right here. So David Epstein is talking about a test that he gave. I'm not sure if he gave it to students or if it was just some study where he was reading this, but it starts off by saying, the test gauged students' ability to apply fundamental abstract concepts from economics, social and physical sciences, and logic to common real-world scenarios. It was about the Flynn effect. Flynn was bemused to find that the correlation between the test of broad conceptual thinking and GPA was about zero. In Flynn's words, the traits that earn good grades at XYZ University do not include critical ability of any broad significance. And if you were brought up in a traditional schooling system, chances are you were taught to study for the test, understand how to do certain problems for the test so that you could get a good grade on the test, so that you can ultimately get a good GPA. And the Flynn effect shows that getting good grades really doesn't lead you to have any good abilities for broad critical thinking beyond the scope of that specific skill that you're, or subject that you're trying to learn, whether it's from science, economics, to psychology. And I thought what was interesting further on in the book is part of the impetus for David for writing this book apparently was to talk about raising children and parents. And if you try to tie this back to parents wanting to have their children be amazing musicians or to have great careers down the line, they try to most parents will want to optimize for getting your kids starting early on a music instrument or going to summer schools and summer camps to learn different subjects and going to prep schools to get better at taking the SATs or AP tests. And the book basically kind of talks about how this type of child rearing is kind of wrong. It's like the opposite of the whole tiger mom approach to raising children. And yeah, I think back to my own childhood of like how I was brought up to focus on, you know, learning the piano and getting good grades and didn't have a lot of time to experiment with different hobbies. I kind of had to do it like when I was done doing my homework, so to speak. And perhaps if I was given more time to learn and stumble into some of these new hobbies, I would have been able to have a more rewarding childhood, adolescence, career, maybe, who knows. And this is obviously very controversial for many parents who are quote unquote the helicopter parents who have to monitor everything that their children do. And this is, you know, whether or not you believe in this type of stumbling into things, I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that there is a different model for becoming an expert on a specific skill. And that's kind of like one of the key takeaways for me from reading Range. And yeah, I think this quote really kind of paints a really good picture of how when you study for a specific subject, it doesn't really lead to any broad significance, as Flynn calls it in this book. The second passage is this concept of interleaving. And from a very broad perspective, interleaving is kind of going along the same lines of how you can mix and match concepts and ideas and theories between different fields of thought and different industries even. And so this quote is all about interleaving. On page, actually, I don't have the page number here, but here is the passage regardless. Interleaving has been shown to improve inductive reasoning. When presented with different examples mixed together, students learn to create abstract generalizations that allow them to apply what they learned to material they have never encountered before. For example, say you plan to visit a museum and want to be able to identify the artist, Cezanne, Picasso, or Renoir, of paintings there that you have never seen. Before you go, instead of studying a stack of Cezanne flashcards and then a stack of Picasso flashcards and then a stack of Renoir, you should put the cards together and shuffle, so they will be interleaved. You will struggle more and probably feel less confident during practice, but be better equipped on museum day to discern each painter's style, even for paintings that weren't in the flashcards. And this is closely related to the first passage where you can constantly study the same subject and get really good at identifying a Picasso painting, but the minute you are faced with a new scenario, you're confronted with a unknown painting in this passage, you only have this framework for Picasso. And this whole concept of interleaving of I like to think of it as bobbing and weaving between different things, I think really goes to give you that broad skill set of being able to interpret a new situation, an unknown situation, which, you know, life is full of, and being able to apply different lenses to that situation. Versus, you know, again, bringing back to parents and helicopter parents, you are helping your kids you want your kids to be focused on a certain subject because you believe that it will give them success down the road, but in reality, it could lead to them not knowing how to deal with the unknown qualities and unknown circumstances, situations in the world. And I promise I'll bring this back to Excel and hopefully, excuse me, hopefully this will spark some ideas for you, is when I first started learning Excel, I was learning primarily to create dashboards and reports. I think that's the way a lot of people are using Excel when they're working as an analyst. And you see Excel as being primarily as just, I plug in numbers, write the formulas to make the numbers balance out, format it, and then make it look nice to be able to be printed out onto a report or to put into a PowerPoint. And that's it. And if you take classes, if you take workshops where you're just learning how to format and move data around, you could totally succeed in that job. But the minute that you want to expand your responsibilities to something like, let's say, financial analysis, to some more deal, to modeling, you have to think a little bit more outside the box. And I definitely want to talk more specifically about modeling, because you can learn the basics of growth rates and, you know, CAGRs and how to write different formulas. But when you're approached with a new real life problem and you have to model it in Excel, one of the fun parts for me and for most analysts and modelers out there is being able to take a very qualitative, subjective, irrational situation or scenario and being able to tie that to numbers and being able to do a sensitivity analysis on that scenario, and then being able to predict whether it's through a sensitivity analysis or through some kind of regression model, being able to predict future performance and future data points. And that's one of the most fun parts of modeling. But that, if you just try to study the formulas and try to study how to format numbers perfectly in Excel, you're never going to understand how to take an unknown situation or a scenario and turn that into a model. You may have a perfect model for, you know, analyzing the food and beverage industry, but the minute you take that to construction, it completely falls apart because there's whole new inputs and completely new set of business logic that you have to deal with. And so that to me is, I think modeling to me is one of the, kind of shows the ability of someone being able to interleave different skill sets and being able to apply a growth rate formula across different industries and different scenarios, where you can't just study it and know that it's always going to work. You have to take into account all the different nuances of the situation. Now, when I think about broadening this a little bit even more in terms of me stumbling around in Excel, I'm just trying to go back to the book really quick here. There's one thing I wanted to point out. Quitting. So one thing that David Epstein talks about in Range is the fact that people, again, this is a little controversial and counter to what you see a lot in the media and other kind of, you know, self-help books, if you will, is quitting actually could be good. Quitting is a way for you to, as David puts it, is important because it allows you to move on to new things, and perhaps persevering actually may be detrimental to your development of a specific skill. And I think about when I first learned Excel and I realized, wow, Excel can be used for so much more than dashboarding. I started looking into, wow, what if I could like build whole workflows into Excel and build little tools. And when I click, maybe create like a little ActiveX control button, I can actually have that trigger other operations in Excel. And then I started digging into VBA and like writing macros and automating different workflows. And then before I knew it, I was like, wait a minute, like, this is just automating little silly workflows in Excel. I wonder if I could do this for other more generic applications. And that's when the light bulb kind of turned off for me, which was trying to learn how to code or program with Python, with R for data visualization, getting into general web development. I realized that web development in many regards, is not that different from creating a really well-functioning tool in Excel. And so that exploration was what kind of led me to move into that range. And so, yeah, that's kind of something interesting I wanted to point out on the ability to move from one subject to another. Broadening the scope a little higher, earlier I talked about being a financial modeler, you're faced with these different scenarios and you have to take your knowledge about financial modeling and apply it to all these different use cases and scenarios that you may have not seen before. But it works out beautifully when you can put it into a model that is able to give you different give you different forecasts and analyses for how things may play out in the future. And if you take this back up one step from moving from Excel to other applications that involve data, I think in regards to the concepts and range, it's about understanding that Excel is great for certain analyses and for certain data sets, but then the minute you go on to other workflows where it requires you to take actions and for you to get feedback from teammates or clients, Excel may not, I said this many times in the past, Excel is not always the best tool. And when you start seeing the patterns in creating a web app, creating a website, creating a mobile app, building these tools involves some common patterns. And I think the biggest framework for me in understanding how all these things tie together is the MVC framework, Model View Controller. Given today's stack, I think the MVC framework is a little outdated, but just understanding that concept allowed me to take what I knew in Excel, which was starting with just creating a dashboard and moving that into other arenas like websites and web apps and other kinds of web development tools. I realized that that framework really applies to everything. And you can apply that framework, the MVC framework, to Excel, to a web app. And it's a pretty powerful statement when you think about it's a pretty mind-opening concept when I realized that I wasn't doing anything that different from what a front-end web developer does. And when I was doing some more back-end work with pulling data from a database, and at the time I was using Active Record on Ruby on Rails, and it was pretty enlightening to know that, hey, I mean, I'm doing all these really funky formulas in Excel where I'm sorting things and filtering things, and I can do the same thing with Active Record, but it just happens to be different syntax. And then this made me realize the more generic concept that all programming languages are kind of the same. It's all about just manipulating data on the back end and then displaying it in a certain way on the front end. So this book kind of opened my eyes to that concept of taking your domain expertise in one subject and then finding the patterns, finding the kind of these common themes and common threads between other different data platforms where you are basically exposing certain data and filtering data a certain way. To wrap this up, I just wanted to say huge recommendation for this book. It definitely gives you a different perspective on things, and albeit it's a bit controversial, as many people have pointed out, in terms of not trying to specialize too early on one subject or one field, and try to be a chameleon where, you know, you're not going deep into one thing, but rather you're kind of dipping your toes into a lot of different things, and that kind of gives you the best perspective on the world and the people around you, and also may lead to more rewarding career when you are the one that can kind of integrate multiple different perspectives together. All right, so that concludes the main part of the episode, and I want to talk really quickly about one episode that I listened to recently from another podcast called The Changelog, which I've brought up quite a few times in Dear Analyst. And this is from episode 353. It's called The War for the Soul of Open Source. And it's a pretty kind of
what's the right word? A very kind of like, not clickbaity, but very kind of like, what's the word? I just can't think of it right now, but it's like, it's a very powerful headline. The War for the Soul of Open Source. It's very kind of like dramatic and effective. And the guest on the show was Adam Jacob, who was the co-founder and board member of this platform called Chef. And around hour one, they started talking about how MongoDB is a platform that was built to monetize the technology that they created. And the tricky thing is that a lot of these open source communities, it's when there is no monetization plan, it does feel like you as an individual feel like you're part of like this, you're definitely demonstrating the hacker ethic where you're just kind of riffing off of each other's ideas, submitting pull requests, and just taking the technology to the next step. But when it comes to these projects, which seem like open source in the case of MongoDB, where they are currently monetizing their platform and through, I think specific licenses, the boundary between open source and basically a business becomes very blurred. And I think what they talked about in the episode, which is really interesting, was how people would go to the MongoDB project with the intention of wanting to be a part of a community, being a part of like a project that prides itself on pushing things forward and doing things unnecessarily for a monetary goal. When you project those values onto the community you're joining, you have to be very careful in that you understand why that project was created in the first place. If it was very explicitly created for monetizing, you just be aware that, you know, everything that this company does is for the goal of monetizing their code, monetizing their technology. Whereas a lot of open source projects are purely just there for the sake of passion, for the sake of ideas. And that's a different type of value set that you as a contributor to the project have to understand. And so I think there are situations where these projects that maybe turn into kind of monetization projects where they have moved to a different kind of license, it does get into that blurred lines. And how do you communicate that to the community of people who have been with you since day one? I think I'm hearing different podcasts where those projects that do stay, that do kind of convert from an open source to a monetizing project, those are the trickiest ones to navigate with the community, because the community up to that point has been supporting the project for the just out of pure passion and kind of side project kind of stuff. But then once you get into projects that are monetizing the technology, well, then it begs to have the conversation of, should you be paying the people who are contributing? Should you be getting them as kind of, what are they called? System integrators for bringing the technology to other organizations and other stacks. I think we face that, for my company, we face that struggle sometimes internally as well, since we have a community of people who build on the platform. We're clearly a for-profit company, and we want to explore ways to monetarily award people in the community who are just doing amazing work and helping others in the community out. But it is a fine line to cross, and we're still trying to figure it out, as are many projects. And the title, again, The War for the Soul of Open Source, I haven't really contributed that much to open source projects, but I do hear and see a lot of these projects that are taking off online, on, you know, seeing different repos on GitHub and stuff like that. And I'm always curious how the project owners are able to sustain themselves. And it turns out that a lot of them are, you know, doing consulting and monetizing their projects, but at the same time, many people just do it out of pure passion and, you know, doing it on the weekends and nights and stuff like that. So ever changing world here in terms of open source, and really interesting hearing this conversation. Highly encourage you all to listen to this episode if you are interested in open source technologies and the communities behind them. And that wraps up this episode of Dear Analyst.